Hello and welcome to another episode of Word Magazine. This is Jeff Riddle, pastor of Christ Reformed Baptist Church in Louisa, Virginia. Today is Tuesday, July the 11th of 2017. I have not done Word Magazine here in a couple of weeks after doing Word Magazine 77 relating to the text of Jude 5. And I want to get back in the game. I had a friend and member of my church on Sunday was chiding me for not putting much on my blog up recently and not putting up any Word magazines. And I was telling him that I have been not been able to do much lately because I'm working on a project designing a survey of the Old Testament class, an online version of it for the school that I teach for. I've previously done an online survey of the New Testament class, and now I'm working on this Old Testament class. So basically all of my extra time has kind of gone into that recently. So there hasn't been a much on my blog, and I haven't done, again, one of these Word magazines. But I'm going to remedy that today. I actually have, I happen to be in an office at the college where I'm teaching, but in my study at home and my library at home, I put up a bulletin board, and I have actually listed, I think, about 8 or 10 topics for Word magazines that I've wanted to do, and I'm kind of crossing them off as I'm able to do them. And actually, the Word magazine on Jude 5 was the first one that was on that list. I got that one done, and this is the second one that's on the list. Well, okay, what's this episode going to be about? In this episode, I'm going to be offering a review of the Christian Standard Bible, a new Bible translation, which is a revision of another Bible translation, the Holman Christian Standard Bible. But the Christian Standard Bible has just been newly released this year, and I have a copy of it and just reviewed it, looked at some things online regarding it, and want to offer some reviews and reactions to the material within it. This was in the news a couple of weeks ago when the Southern Baptist Convention was held in June. There was some talk and controversy about the gender inclusivity of the translation, and we'll look at that. I'm going to cite some examples from that, but it's sort of indicates some of, I think, the problems with what's happened within English-speaking Christianity, and particularly within the evangelical subculture, the continual production and revision of English Bible translations, which are supposedly intended to increase people's interest in the Bible, but what has, I think, practically resulted is actually a lowering of interest and a division so that there's no common biblical language that people are speaking today without truly a standard English translation in use in the English-speaking world, and particularly in the evangelical subculture. So let's go ahead and get into this. By the way, I will have my notes, which are pretty extensive, about 4 pages of notes I have, that I'm going to put on my blog at jeffriddle.net, and you can read and follow some links to some articles that I'll cite. Anyways, so back in 2003, the Holman Christian Standard Bible, HCSB, was produced. And back in those days, I was in Southern Baptist ministry. I since made a transition to Reformed Baptist life, came to confessional convictions, but I grew up in Southern Baptist life, and my ministry was initially in Southern Baptist life. But Lifeway Publications is sort of the publishing arm of the Southern Baptist Convention. I remember what it used to be called, I think, the Sunday School Board. But they made a name change to Lifeway. Southern Baptist Convention supposedly is the largest evangelical denomination. There's some question about that because there's always been a problem with inflating numbers, counting nickels and noses, and sometimes trying to claim more influence, I think, than actually is a reality for Southern Baptists. It's kind of interesting, being a former Southern Baptist, being outside of it, I really don't follow it that much anymore, and I sort of looked at a few things related to their annual meeting convention, and just was reminded of some of the reasons I'm glad I'm not in it anymore. But anyways, I'm more interested in this Bible translation. But I remember when it came out in 2003, and as I understood it at the time, I thought that it was produced in part in order to escape having to pay royalties to Zondervan for the use of the NIV text in Lifeway publications, and in particular in their publications of materials for Southern Baptist churches like Sunday School Literature, Vacation Bible School Matura, and other things, that they wanted to have their own translation, that they weren't having to constantly, again, pay someone else to cite. And I think in the Sunday School Literature, as I remember, it's been a long time, it used to have the King James Version and the NIV, and then when they, after 2003, when they came out with the Holman Christian Standard Bible, it was the King James Version and the Holman Christian Standard Bible. The Holman Christian Standard Bible, you know, is typical, I think, of modern translations. It essentially followed the modern critical text of the day. And those, I guess it would have been the initially in 2003, the NA 26 or 27 for the New Testament, essentially followed the Masoretic text of the Old Testament with the sort of some of the typical modern adjustments for the Septuagintal readings and so forth. And then it followed a hybrid, sort of like the NIV, a hybrid between formal equivalents at some points and dynamic equivalents at others. So that was done in 2003. 14 years later now, we have a revision of it that's being put in the market, of course, because we can never arrive at a definitive translation. We have to constantly be tweaking it and making changes and updates and so-called improvements. They have changed the name of the translation. They've dropped the Holman. Maybe that was thought to be too parochial. They want to reach perhaps a non-Southern Baptist audience who maybe people wouldn't have any idea what Holman has to do with, and I think Holman is now the title given to the academic division of Lifeway's publishing, the academic products that they put out. But they sort of dropped that, and they're just calling it the Christian Standard Bible, CSB. And seemed like one of their slogans, looking at it online and on the cover of the paper copy I have, is faithful and true. There is a Christian Standard Bible website. I'll have a link to this on the blog post that I'm going to do. And it's a good website if you want to explore and learn more about the Christian Standard Bible. There's a section tab called About the CSB, and then under that there is a Why the CSB, Translation Philosophy, Translation Oversight Committee, History of the CSB, Endorsements, Frequently Asked Questions, and a blog. And I would point you in particular to the Frequently Asked Questions page, where there are lots of questions and brief responses to help you understand this Bible. On the initial Why the CSB page, it notes a Barna study, a George Barna study, which suggests that Bible ownership is up, but Bible reading is down. And so why is that, they ask? And their conclusion is the reason people aren't reading the Bible is they don't have an optimally translated Bible that is meaningful for today's English reader. And so they see themselves, according to this at least, as stepping into this gap to help modern readers who can't understand any of the scores of other modern English Bibles, that they need something to help them understand this complex, almost indecipherable work, the Bible. And it is that, certainly, for those who do not have ears to hear. you probably already would understand that I don't think that the problem with people reading the Bibles is that they lack the CSB. The problem typically is that they lack spiritual life and they have no desire and interest in reading the Word of God. But the CSB was apparently revised, according to the website, through the work of more than 100 scholars under the supervision of a 10-member translation oversight committee. And looking at the page that lists the translation oversight committee, it includes an array of scholars, primarily those coming out of Southern Baptist life, although there are a couple of Lutheran Church Missouri Synod scholars, I think one Anglican scholar is included in the list. The co-chairs of the committee who revised the Christian Standard Bible are Thomas Schreiner, who is a New Testament scholar, well-respected evangelical New Testament scholar, who teaches at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, and David Allen, who is a professor of preaching at Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. And I found that kind of interesting because you would think perhaps the co-chairs would be an Old Testament scholar and a New Testament scholar. And there are several Old Testament scholars, including a woman, Dorian Coover Cox, let's see, who is an associate professor of Old Testament at Dallas Seminary, including an Old Testament professor from Westminster Seminary. Oh, and I should mention that the stylist, this is a new thing with many of the modern translations, they have an English language stylist. The stylist for the CSB is the contemporary Christian music artist Michael Card. And I thought that was interesting. I'm just looking at his, pulled up his page, and it says denominational affiliation for him is non-denominational. And I thought at one point maybe he had some Roman Catholic connections, but I'm doubting that Lifeway would have picked him up, but who knows. He's listed here as non-denominational. I would think maybe they would have an Old Testament, New Testament, but instead they've got a New Testament guy and a preaching professor, and I kind of wonder if they didn't have these two men as the co-chairs as a sort of a nod to political balance in the SBC between Calvinists, and Schreiner would be a soteriological Calvinist, although he's not confessionally reformed as far as I know, and non-Calvinists. And there's a controversy sub-story in the SBC conflict between Calvinism, which has grown and maybe reached its peak and is declining now, but interest in soteriological Calvinism, spurred on, you know, by John Piper's popularity and Mark Dever's Nine Marks ministry, and young Restless Reformed, or young Restless and soteriologically Calvinistic preachers in the SBC. And then there was a reaction against that by those like Paige Patterson and others, you know, centered at Southwestern Seminary, those who would call themselves traditional Southern Baptists. Of course, there's a conflict there because according to the Founders Ministry, traditional Southern Baptists would have been at least Calvinistic and maybe even confessional. But by their version of traditionalists, they mean essentially Arminian, new measures using Southern Baptists. And David Allen has been in the thick of that. And so perhaps they had him as a co-chair so that this translation would be with approval of both Calvinists and non-Calvinists or traditionalists in SBC life. There were apparently advanced copies of the CSB that were distributed in the fall 2016 Evangelical Theological Society meeting, and I did not attend that. I'm not a member of ETS any longer. I was at one time, but you You could also get reading copies. I'm not sure if this is still available or not, but I saw a note back in January that they were sending out free reading copies, and so I ordered one. I've actually had this copy sitting on my desk since January or February of this year. But I was hoping that the copy they would send would have their footnotes, of course, for the text. I was very interested in that. And they do have notes at, you know, the big points, like Mark 16, 9 through 20. And, of course, the note says that they raises question, the typical questions about the authenticity of the ending of Mark that we find in modern translations. Let me just read exactly what it says. I'm flipping through my paper copy right now. It has after verse 8 a solid line, and then in brackets some of the early manuscripts conclude with 16:8, and then it has in brackets verses 9 through 20. At least they don't include the shorter ending within the text, as the New Living Translation now does, and the New Revised Standard Version do. But anyways, and they have a similar note at John 7:53 through 8:11. But they have other notes in sort of fuller editions of it, and what I got was just a kind of a reading copy. But I've been able to read some of the comments, remarks. We'll get to in just a moment of those who've examined some of the text notes in the New Christian Standard Bible. Looking at this reading copy that I have, and when you look at an English Bible translation, you should always start out by reading the introduction, the sort of the front matter. And there is a little brief two-page introduction. It starts off, the Bible is God's revelation to humanity. It is our only source for completely reliable information about God, what happens when we die, and where history is headed. The Bible does these things because it is God's inspired word, inerrant in the original manuscript. So it sort of, you know, puts itself in that modern inerrancy of Scripture in the original manuscripts. Who knows what's happened with the copies, but it presents, again, the sort of typical modern evangelical view. Key here is, first of all, it addresses the text. What text did the Christian Standard Bible use for this revision of the Holman Christian Standard Bible? Here's the couple of paragraphs on this. It says, the textual basis for the New Testament is the Nestle-Aland Novum Testamentum Graecae 28th edition and the United Bible Society's Greek New Testament 5th corrected edition. The text for the Old Testament is the Biblia Hebraica Stuttgartensia 5th edition. Where there are significant differences among Hebrew, Aramaic, or Greek manuscripts, the translators follow what they believe is the original reading and indicate the main alternative or alternatives. In footnotes, the CSB uses the traditional verse divisions found in most Protestant Bibles. So it's kind of interesting. They start off not with the Old Testament. They don't go in the sort of canonical order. They start off with the New Testament, and they say they're following, you know, the Novum Testamentum Graecae 28th edition of 2012. So the latest edition of the modern critical Greek text, same text reflected in the UBS 5th corrected edition. Then for the Old Testament, they use the Biblia Hebraica Stuttgartensia 5th edition, the latest critical edition of the Old Testament, though, which primarily follows the Masoretic text, though it has notes of alternative readings from the Septuagint and the Latin Vulgate, the Dead Sea Scrolls, etc., in its footnotes. So that's the text. They're going to use the modern critical text. No big surprise for a modern translation. The Holman Christian Standard Bible is also based on the most recent editions of the modern critical text as they stood in 2003. And again, this is why is it these Bibles have to be updated? I have a feeling probably this one is done more for marketing reasons, to sort of put something fresh on the market and introduce, you know, more interest in it. But another reason is when you've hitched your wagon to the modern critical text, you're going to have to constantly be updating and changing it and revising, because they're going to be constant revised editions of the modern critical text. With regard to its translation philosophy, it starts off with a section here. Most discussions of Bible translation speak of two opposite approaches, formal equivalence and dynamic equivalence. And then it gives a description of formal equivalence and dynamic equivalence. However, the CSB editors say we're not going to follow either one of those. Instead, we're going to follow a new thing, and it's called optimal equivalence. And it says, in practice, translations are seldom, if ever, purely formal or dynamic, but favor one theory of the Bible translation or the other. Optimal equivalence as a translation philosophy recognizes that form cannot always be neatly separated from meaning and should not be changed unless comprehension demands it. The primary goal of translation is to convey the sense of the original with as much clarity as the original text and the translation language permit. Optimal equivalence appreciates the goals of formal equivalence, but also recognizes its limitations. So they're saying we're going to have this via media. We're going to have this middle way between formal equivalence and dynamic equivalence, and we're going to alter our commitment to formal equivalence if the context and the conveying of meaning absolutely demands it, so that there can be optimal comprehension. We'll come back to that in a moment, and we're going to examine a few passages to see whether or not we think they were able to succeed in that goal, whether you really can have something that's a hybrid, a successful hybrid between formal equivalence and dynamic equivalence. There's also a section within the front matter, these two introductory pages, on gender language. The heading is the gender language use in Bible translations, and it says this: the goal of the translators of the Christian Standard Bible has not been to promote a cultural ideology, but to translate the Bible faithfully. Recognizing modern usage of English, the CSB regularly translates the plural of the Greek word anthropos, man, as people instead of men, and occasionally the singular as one, someone, or everyone. When the supporting pronouns in the original languages validate such a translation, while the CSB avoids using he or him unnecessarily, the translation does not restructure sentences to avoid them when they are in the text. Although they say they have not changed the translation to promote a cultural ideology, they essentially have told us there that they have adopted some measure, at least, of gender inclusivity. So every time there's anthropos, man, and it does mean human being, but typically in the Tyndale tradition, the masculine term has been used, even though it's an inclusive term. Man means men and women, man or woman. Mankind means humanity. But anyways, they have adopted this. And this is the thing that has, I think, proved to be controversial about the Christian Standard Bible. I first heard about this, again, when the SBC was meeting. It showed up in some of my news feeds. And in particular, there was an article that was published in The Atlantic magazine. And I'll have a link to this. The article was written by Jonathan Merritt, and Jonathan Merritt is a journalist writer who is the son of a SBC mega pastor and former president of the Southern Baptist Convention. Merritt was in some controversy a couple of years ago about his own sexual identity, and there was some controversy about that. But anyways, he's a sort of a frequent commentator on evangelical life and SBC life, and is sort of a left-wing evangelical, supposedly. He is an environmental advocate, an advocate for the church being kinder and gentler in its language toward homosexuals and homosexual practice, etc. Anyway, so there's this article co-written with Jonathan Merritt and Garrett Robinson, and the title of it was Southern Baptists Embrace Gender-Inclusive Language in the Bible. Subtitle, America's largest Protestant denomination has produced a revised translation that incorporates many features it had long condemned. And so this appeared June 11, 2017, and he points out there's the announcement of this new Bible. Lifeway Christian Stores are going to promote this. But he says patrons are largely unaware that the denomination-approved translation is gender-inclusive. And he points out that earlier, Southern Baptists have opposed updates to the NIV, and I think this was also presented as another reason for the Holman Christian Standard Bible, was the NIV was adopting more gender-inclusive language. They passed resolutions in Southern Baptist Convention meetings condemning updates to the NIV. And then, though, Merritt points out, despite all of that rhetoric, they have now essentially gone down the same path with the Christian Standard Bible as the NIV has gone. And he points out some of the changes. Inclusive translations abolish many gender-specific terms. They may change father to parent, son to child, man to mortal. He says, he notes the CSB now translates the term anthropos, a Greek word for man in a gender-neutral form 151 times, rendering it human, people, and ones. The previous edition had done this on occasion. The new revision adds almost 100 more instances. Men of Israel becomes fellow Israelites. When discussing Jesus' incarnation, the likeness of men becomes likeness of humanity. The CSB translates the term adelphoi, a Greek word for brother, in a gender-neutral form 106 times, often adding sister. So instead of brethren or brothers, it's brothers and sisters. Brotherly love is translated as love as brothers and sisters. And he talks about this gender-neutralizing pattern also being present within the Old Testament. Again, I'll put a link to the article. You can read it. He points out that the frequently asked question page for the Christian Standard Bible notes that the committee chose to avoid being unnecessarily specific in passages where the original context did not exclude females. And he also talks about corresponding with Trevin Wax, who was the Bible and reference publisher for Holman Christian Bibles, sort of ran this project. He's on the Translation Oversight Committee, along with the scholars who worked on it, and the stylist, Michael Card. And he notes that apparently in his email interactions that Wax said, no, we're not, this isn't a gender-neutral translation. This is a gender-accurate approach, not gender neutral, but gender accurate. But it sounds like gender accurate just sounds a lot like gender neutral. So anyways, that's the sort of controversy that arose. I think many sort of traditional Southern Baptists, not to mention just more conservative evangelicals, probably will not be happy with this, and it's probably not going to help the sales of this Bible very much, this controversy about it relating to gender inclusivity. Of course, if it's going to be used by Holman or by Holman Publishing and Lifeway, it's going to get into a lot of material. It's going to be published a lot just through Southern Baptist publications. I went through and just looked at a few passages and did, you know, this is not extensive, but just a few comparisons, and I put these together in a table, and I'll put this again up on my blog, jeffriddle.net. You can look at some of these, and let me just cite a few. Let's see, I've gotten wrote down 3, 4, 5, 6 passages here, and I, what I've done is I've put the passage in the King James Version, then in the Holman Christian Standard Bible 2003, and in the Christian Standard Bible of 2017. So the first one is Psalm 1:1, the opening verse of the first psalm. And in the King James Version, it reads, "Blessed is the man that walketh not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor standeth in the way of sinners, nor sitteth in the seat of the scornful." Now, the Holman Christian Standard Bible of 2003 had changed those opening words, and yet, "Blessed is the man." It's a gender-specific term, man, even though it's used, I think, inclusively. It means, of course, the man or the woman, although there certainly is an emphasis on the leading role of men within home, church, family, society. So it changes it to how happy is the man. It actually keeps man. Holman Christian Standard Bible 2003 retained man. It did what many modern translations do, takes the biblical word baruch, blessed, and changes it to happy. I really question the wisdom of that, though, because happy seems like in modern context is a very confusing term, you know. And I'm not sure that word really captures the biblical sense of being blessed. Being blessed isn't necessarily the equivalent of being happy as most modern people would understand it. I think there's something probably good about the perhaps more archaic word blessed. Okay, what about the 2017, the Christian Standard Bible? Now, the opening to this psalm is, "How happy is the one who does not walk in the advice of the wicked, or stand in the pathway with sinners, or sit in the company of mockers." So now it's, "How happy is the one." And I don't know. I just love the traditional language of the King James Version. "Blessed is the man that walketh not in the counsel of the ungodly." Will we trade that for, "How happy is the one who does not walk in the advice of the wicked"? It just seems weak to me. Psalm 8:4 is another one I looked at in the King James Version. It reads, "What is man that thou art mindful of him, and the son of man that thou visitest him?" The Holman Christian Standard Bible of 2003 read, "What is man that you remember him, the son of man that you look after him?" And so it retained man. I might also, when you look at the comparisons, one of the things you'll notice is the Holman Christian Standard Bible, kind of like the New King James Version, attempted to capitalize all the pronouns in reference to God. And so here in the Holman Christian Standard Bible for Psalm 8:4, when it says, "What is man that you remember him," the "you" is capitalized. The Christian Standard Bible 2017, one of its changes is it drops the attempt to capitalize the divine pronouns. I think that's actually a good decision. I don't think it's wise for modern translations to do that. King James Version doesn't do that, for example. It's certainly not bespeaking any lack of reverence to God to do that. It's not there in the original languages. They don't capitalize the first letter of the pronouns in reference to the divine name or to divine pronouns, rather. So Christian Standard Bible 2017, Psalm 8:4, says, "What is a human being that you remember him, and a son of man that you look after him?" So it changes, "What is man that thou art mindful of him?" What a beautiful poetic statement. It changes that to, "What is a human being that you remember him?" That just sounds so pedantic. But again, it also changes man to human being. So it takes a one-syllable, rugged, strong word, what is man, and it changes it into a four-syllable, gender-inclusive statement. What is a human being that you remember him? What about Micah 6:8, another passage? King James Version, he hath showed thee, O man, what is good, and what doth the Lord require of thee, but to do justly, and to love mercy, and to walk humbly with thy God. The Holman Christian Standard Bible, 2003, he has told you men what is good, and what it is the Lord requires of you, only to act justly, to love faithfulness, and to walk humbly with your God. Now, the Christian Standard Bible, 2017, it says, interestingly enough, mankind, he has told each of you what is good and what it is the Lord requires of you. So instead of, oh man, it renders it in a form of the masculine plural. Doesn't say humanity, but says mankind. So kind of interesting there. What about John chapter 1, verse 12? John 1, 12. King James Version says, but as many as received him, to them gave he power to become the sons of God, even to them that believe on his name. So Christians are the sons of God, which is a literal reading of the Greek. We are the huioi tou theou, the sons of God. Holman Christian Standard Bible says, but to all who did receive him, he gave them the right to be children of God, to those who believe in his name. So already in the Holman Christian Standard Bible, there is a gender-neutralizing effort, and there's no big change with the Christian Standard Bible 2017. It essentially is the same, but to all who did receive him, he gave them the right to be children of God, to those who believe in his name. So this isn't really a change with the Christian Standard Bible 2017, but it's the continuation of a gender inclusive trend that was already there in 2003. And, well, what's the problem with this? For one thing, the original language is sons of God. And then, secondly, I think there's something theologically significant about Christians being called sons of God. Behind this is adoptionistic theology. Behind this is the cultural context that says that that a male adopted son would be the heir, and it was very common for a childless family or family without a son to adopt a man to take over his position and share with him fully in all his rights as his son and heir. And so when we say that believers are sons of God, that means men and women. It actually says something much more radical about the implications of the gospel for women. I think that they are called sons of God than to gender neutralize it and simply say they are children of God. Philippians 2:7, in the King James Version, it says, this is from the Christ hymn, that Christ made himself of no reputation, but took upon him the form of a servant and was made in the likeness of men. The Holman Christian Standard Bible 2003 says, instead he emptied himself by assuming the form of a slave, taking on the likeness of men. So it kept that traditional language. The Christian Standard Bible 2017, getting confused with all these standard Bible names. Anyways, it says, instead he emptied himself by assuming the form of a servant. That's interesting. where Holman Christian Standard Bible went to slave. The Christian Standard Bible 2017 goes back to servant. And then it says, taking on the likeness of humanity. Not the likeness of men, but of humanity. Example of the gender inclusive, or as Kevin Wax said, gender accurate, as he believes it, position. And then the last one I'll look at is Hebrews 2:10. In the King James Version, it says, "For it became him for whom are all things, and by whom are all things, in bringing many sons unto glory, to make the captain of their salvation perfect through sufferings." The Holman Christian Standard Bible 2003, "For it was fitting in bringing many sons to glory," etc. But the Christian Standard Bible 2017 says, "For in bringing many sons and daughters to glory." So this would be an example of again, taking a gender term in the original language, sons, huioi, masculine, plural, from huios, son, and adding something that's not really in the text, is supposedly to make this more palpable to feminist-influenced modern readers, those who wouldn't be bright enough to realize that when it talks about sons, that Christians are sons who are brought to glory, that includes men and women. And as I said, may actually undermine some of the power of the gospel for women, that they are fully incorporated. They are sons of God. They have a status that the world cannot, doesn't give to women in the society of their time. It's so I'm wondering if this gender inclusive language in the end doesn't just dull some of the raw power of what's there in the original gender specific language. Just going back, some of the phrasings, you can look at the comparison yourself, and you read just the poetic, beautiful poetic language of the King James Version, and the very pedestrian, pedantic, simplified, non-poetic language of these modern translations. It just makes the King James Version language stand out all the stronger. The Tyndale tradition language stand out all the stronger. And that's despite the fact that they had Michael Card as a stylist. Reading through this sort of reminded me of the poet T.S. Eliot's review of the New English Bible, in which he described it as, quote, "an active agent of decadence," end quote. So modern translations are agents of decadence. It doesn't make the Bible more accessible to people, but it brings down the rhetorical power and beauty of the language of the Bible. Again, the controversy over the gender inclusive language is the thing that showed up in various news sites and is still being talked about. Question about how it will affect the promotion of the Christian Standard Bible in SBC circles and in some evangelical circles. I should have noted that there were a lot of things about the rollout for this that reminded me of how the English Standard Version, and particularly the English Standard Version Study Bible, was promoted, and they also have on that site an endorsements page, and I took a look at that. I'm pulling it up right now, and the only note person that I recognized there was Alistair Begg of Parkside Church in Cleveland. He is someone who's endorsed it. David Platt, also from the International Mission Board or the SBC. The other persons I don't really recognize. There are a number of women, number of African Americans, number of, looks like a lot of young persons. Oh, one of the persons I recognize is David Dockery, former president of Union University in Tennessee. Danny Aiken, Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. Robert Plummer from Southern Seminary in Louisville. Looks like a lot of other younger pastors. A lot of them look like from maybe SBC Life, although a number of them seem like they're coming from sort of new style churches. A guy from a church named City Church, a guy from a church named Redeemer Church, Cornerstone Church, churches that don't have Baptist in the name. Then seemed like a few. Axis Church is one pastor from that church endorses it. But anyways, it doesn't have the kind of list of evangelical luminaries that accompanied the ESV when it was promoted in the bandwagon promotion. Was put out there. So controversy over the gender inclusive part, but I think something else of equal significance are questions that could be raised about the text that underlies the Christian Standard Bible. This showed up on my radar screen actually again way back in January. So I've been thinking about this really since January. There was a blog article that was posted by Peter Gurry, who's now down in Arizona at Phoenix Seminary, and I guess he probably was still at Cambridge when he put this post up in January. But it was a blog article, January 25, 2017. I'll have a link to this again on jeffriddle.net on the article. For this Word magazine, but it was titled "The New Christian Standard Bible and the NA28," and Gurry went through and looked at the New Christian Standard Bible and looked at textual matters, and he was looking in particular to see whether it had adopted some of the readings from the Catholic epistles that are new to the NA28, and he found that yes, they did take the reading of Jesus rather than the traditional reading of the Lord at Jude 5, but at 2 Peter 3:10, he found they did not follow the conjectural emendation that is now the reading in the NA28, and instead they kept the same reading that's there in the NA27. I'll put another table up on this on my notes where you can compare some of the readings from the King James Version, which would follow the traditional text, and the ESV, which would be translation that would follow the modern critical text, but the NA27 and the Christian Standard Bible 2017, which again, they said they were going to follow the NA28 and the UBS Fifth Corrected Edition, but without really explaining why they don't do that at 2 Peter 3:10. 2 Peter 3:10 in the King James Version, and the question here is the very end of it. It says, "And the works that are therein shall be burned up." The traditional text, there's a issue with the verb. In the Textus Receptus, there's a verb there, kata, ka esetai, to be burned up. In the NA27, the Modern Critical Edition, it's a verb, Yure thesatai, which means to be exposed or opened or disclosed. And so in the ESV, it says, "And the works that are done on it will be exposed." The Christian Standard Bible 2017 says, "And the earth and the works on it will be disclosed." And they don't follow the Nestle-Lan 28th edition, which includes a conjecture, not in any Greek manuscript, using the negative particle ouk, and will actually read, "It will not be exposed." So at the end of the ages, when the day of the Lord comes like a thief in the night, the earth and the works on it will not be disclosed, not be exposed. And he sort of points out that he raises some questions about the footnotes. Again, I didn't have these in the sort of reading copy that I have. And he takes exception to the fact that in the Christian Standard Bible, they now apparently have two notes. And one note says at the point where it reads, will be disclosed, the note says, other manuscripts read, will be burned up. And then it adds a second footnote that says, or will not be found. And this is probably a reference, Gurry points out, to the conjecture found in NA 28. Ook, so it says some or will not be found. And let me just read exactly what Gurry says. What I find unhelpful is the sequence of notes in the CSB. Since both notes are given back to back, I think most people will naturally read them together as, quote, some manuscripts read will be burned up and some manuscripts read will not be found. This is not what the second note explicitly says, of course, but how else are people expected to read it? Then he says, the problem is that the two alternate readings are here presented to the English reader as if they are on par with one another when they really aren't. The reading of NA 28 is attested by a few Syriac and Coptic witnesses, not Greek, which means this note breaks the translation's own policy that, quote, the Christian Standard Bible uses textual footnotes to show important differences among Hebrew manuscripts and other texts such as the Septuagint and the Vulgate for the Old Testament and between various Greek manuscripts for the New Testament. He goes on to say, don't misunderstand me. I do not expect translation footnotes to do full justice to the external evidence. They can't. That's what critical editions are for, but I don't see how the CSB's current note can do anything other than mislead its readers here. It either needs to be revised to something like some Coptic and Syriac manuscripts read, or be taken out altogether. As it is, it's counterproductive. And again, this is someone who is a modern critical text advocate, and he says the Christian Standard Bible note at 2 Peter 3:10 is misleading. It might make people think that the conjecture in the NA 28 that includes the reading not, that it rests on Greek witnesses instead of what it truly does rest upon, and that is simply some versional witnesses. So that's an interesting discussion. Gurry also points out, he says Maurice Robinson had pointed out to him issues with the Christian Standard Bible's rendering of John 1:18. And some of you might remember that I did a Word Magazine, previously Word Magazine 56, on issues related to John 1:18. It is a very well-known text where there is controversy that exists as to how it should properly read. So in the King James Version, following traditional text, it says, no man have seen God at any time. The only begotten Son, the monogenes huios, which is in the bosom of the Father, he hath declared him. And the issue here is, in the modern critical text, it reads not only begotten Son, but only God. So the ESV, following the modern critical text, says no one has ever seen God. The only God, who is at the Father's side, he has made him known. And again, you can look at WM 56 for the manuscript differences. You can look at the ones that support only begotten Son, the ones that support only God, and what are the Christological issues in both of those statements. Now, Maurice Robinson points out, though, that John 1:18 in the Christian Standard Bible, the revision of this new revision of the Holman Christian Standard Bible, reads, no one has ever seen God, so gender inclusive, not no man, but no one, as in the ESV. And then it says, the one and only Son, who is himself God, and is at the Father's side, he has revealed him. And so essentially what they have done is taken the traditional reading, the only begotten Son, even though they rendered it the one and only Son, and the modern critical reading, the only God, and they've combined them. The one and only Son who is himself God. Well, the problem is that is not the reading that is found in any extant Greek manuscript. I'm going to again give you the link to Gurry's blog post on the Christian Standard Bible in the NA 28, and as interesting as the articles are also the comments that appear below that. And several people point out that combining of the two readings, only begotten Son and only God, appears in the Church Father Eusebius. It's referenced by the 19th century text scholar Tischendorf, but again, it's in no Greek manuscript. So essentially what the Christian Standard Bible has done at John 1:18 has been that it has adopted a complete conjectural emendation at John 1:18 and is not giving a reading that rests in any extant Greek manuscript. I also drew out of the comment section, someone made a point from the Hebrew Bible, from the Old Testament, a problem with the rendering of Jeremiah 1:9. And again, this is certainly not an extensive review, just looking at a few passages. But I thought this one was interesting as well. The King James Version of Jeremiah 1:9 reads, then the Lord put forth his hand and touched my mouth, and the Lord said unto me, behold, I have put my words in thy mouth. The Holman Christian Standard Bible says, then the Lord put out his hand and touched my mouth, and the Lord said unto me, behold, I have put my words in your mouth. The Christian Standard Bible, however, reads as follows. Then the Lord reached out his hand, touched my mouth, and told me, I have now filled your mouth with my words. What's interesting about this, if you look at it, is both the King James Version and the ESV read Lord twice, because it's there in the Hebrew manuscript. The tetragrammaton, the four-consonant name for God, appears twice. Then the Lord put forth his hand and touched my mouth, and the Lord said unto me. And what's interesting, in the Christian Standard Bible, Lord, in all caps, only appears once. So if you were just looking, if you just had the Christian Standard Bible, you would think that the tetragrammaton appears just once in Jeremiah 1:9. They omitted it the second time. Then the Lord reached out his hand, touched my mouth, and told me. So they don't repeat, and the Lord told me. And it's not a huge problem, but it is a problem because it doesn't faithfully give the reader an accurate rendering of what's there in the Hebrew. And so it seems to be an unnecessary distancing from formal equivalence that would help the reader understand better the original reading in the original text. We've gone through the review, and what do we find in the end? Well, in the end, I think probably the Christian Standard Bible will probably not gain a large market share of the English Bible market. I really don't think probably in the end that was truly its goal. I think it continues to have probably as its goal, as with the Holman Christian Standard Bible of 2003, simply to provide an in-house translation for Lifeway Publications, and they don't have to pay royalties to anyone for using it. So I don't think it's going to ensure that more Bible owners will become Bible readers. I mean, that's the Holy Spirit's work anyhow. it seems to me it just adds another translation to the glut of translations that are on the market. I also don't think it's wise to adopt the gender inclusive, or gender, as they call it, gender accurate translation philosophy. And as Gurry points out, there seem to be some problems with the adopting even of the modern critical text by the translators in this translation. So with all those issues, it seems like we have a new translation, but we have some of the same old problems with modern translations that are based on the ever-changing, ever-shifting modern critical text. Well, I hope this review has been helpful, and I will look forward to seeing you again with upcoming Word magazines. I got my list now, so I got to work through it. Till then, take care, and God bless.